Good afternoon. You are listening to 91.9 FM, WDRT in Viroqua, Wisconsin. This is the Heart of Wellness show with host Drs. Paul and Paula Grenier. Today's guest is Robert Karbelnikov. He is a social activist inspired by Rudolf Steiner's vision of a threefold social organism. And let me just say, I am super excited to have Robert on the show today. Confessions of Paula Grenier. You know, Paul and I have raised our children in this community. We've had them attend the Waldorf School. We moved here actually for that reason. We know of the undertones of Waldorf education, but I'm heartily admitting that I haven't personally studied in depth anthroposophy. And it used to be kind of a joke between Paul and I and a few friends that we couldn't even say the word because it's hard to pronounce. We would just call it the A word, right, Paul? How do you say that A word? So, in recent times, the past couple weeks, I've been fortunate to be in conversations, and the Anthroposophical Festival came by in November here in Viroqua, and Robert also did a presentation at this event we had called The Confluence in September, and we talked about that on the radio during that time and gave a beautiful presentation. I'm just pumping you up, Robert, because it was really, really moving. I think it was the economy of love we talked about that day.
Yeah.
So I just said it's time to have this guy on the show with us and to give us a little intro about social threefolding and let our audience know what that's kind of all about.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so excited you're here.
Cool. It's great to be here, both of you.
We always need help in society, so I'm looking forward to hearing some possibilities. Some future possibilities in the current time.
It's a good word. So before we break into the deep conversation of it, maybe you can give our folks a little intro on who you are and how you got to be a social activist inspired by this vision.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Paula. Well, my work in life has been largely in the, I guess what you'd call the sustainable agriculture movement, the local food movement, the organic and biodynamic food movement. And I found my way to these movements when I was in my 20s, my late teens, early 20s. And I was already a student of Rudolf Steiner's work at that time, but I was looking for like an indigenous grassroots social movement that I felt like had potential here in America. A lot of people, they come upon Rudolf Steiner's work and they know they want to be Waldorf teachers, or they know they want to study eurythmy, this art of movement, or medicine, but I was always interested in society, social change. And when I came upon the emergence of the sustainable agriculture movement back in the 80s and the 90s, I was like, wow, here's something powerful. Here's people who aren't going out and protesting to Washington to create an organic food movement. There are people just going out and creating an organic food movement, right? They're doing it. And I really felt this was like a seedbed for new ideas, new thinking, new innovative approaches to economic life and cultural life. So I kind of jumped into that movement. I helped start the first CSA in Iowa.
Really?
I worked in the local food movement in Iowa for a long time.
Okay, first CSA. So just say what a CSA is in case people don't know.
Okay, CSA is a community supported agriculture program. This is where consumers pay up front at the beginning of a growing season for the food they will receive from the farmer. They commit. And this gives the farmer the cash they need to buy the supplies to get a season going, and it gives them stability because the consumers are basically saying, even if you have bad weather, even if the harvest isn't as good as usual, we're committed to you. And this concept, many people don't know about it, but the first CSAs began inspired by Rudolf Steiner's economic ideas. It was people
wow,
who,
sure.
Yeah, it was people who had these ideas who started the CSA movement in the United States.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah. So, and in Iowa, the CSA I helped start there was actually started by a group of consumers, not by, often it's a farmer. But this was a group of consumers who just...
And went out and looked for a farmer.
Yeah, we went out and we found 30 farmers because we couldn't find one farmer who would supply us with everything we wanted because we wanted meat and bread and vegetables and frozen fruit, whatever we could get, you know. So we wound up as a consumer group contracting with like 20,
Sweet.
30 different farmers who would all bring their produce to this church once a week. And then we would divvy it all up. We'd have cooking classes there. And then we'd take anything left over that nobody picked up. We'd take it to the local food pantry.
Wow.
Oh,
so we donated
awesome.
Like
so
thousands
awesome.
Of pounds of food to the food pantry every year. So
that's beautiful.
That's kind of where I began, was like grassroots organizing around food and farming.
So it was the first in Iowa, but not the first in the United States?
Yeah, correct. No, it was not the first. I was a member of one of the first in the United States in Massachusetts. And that's what really... fired me up. That's when I realized, yes, I want to work in the food movement. I want to keep building on some of Steiner's insights in the food movement. And then it just, long story short, I wound up in Iowa right at the time when the first CSA was starting there.
Nice.
What year was that?
The Massachusetts or the Iowa or both?
Iowa.
Iowa, that would have been right around 95.
Okay.
1995. Yeah. And I did that work with Shelley Brenneman, who now lives in Viroqua, by the way.
Oh, that's fun.
Shout out to
Ooh,
Shelley.
Shelley. Yeah, she's over at
Valley Stewardship Network.
Yeah. Wonderful.
Yeah. So, that's anyway, cool. I mean, that's a little bit of my backstory.
Nice. I love that. I did not know that. What I love about this show is when we actually sit down and talk with somebody, we really actually get to know
yes.
them at a deeper level.
Right? Yes. Right.
Like, really get to know, like, who are you? It's super. That's why I love doing this, is getting to
yeah.
know people.
So I don't have this answer, and maybe we don't have to get into it, but the CSA movement, is it still growing fast, or has it hit roadblocks due to government...
what?
Overshadowing.
I mean, I would say the CSA movement has kind of lost a lot of its momentum. It's not only because of government influence. It's, you know, you have to remember that the food movement began before social media, before Facebook and all of these things. And it tapped into an incredible hunger in consumers at that time to be more closely related to their food and to farming. But that energy has trailed off somewhat. People have gotten more consumed in their own lives and their own online social networks. Mm-hmm. And also, I would say, this is maybe a longer story than you want to go into, but there were different models of CSA at the beginning. And the model that was adopted, by and large, that became the most popular was just a share program, like a box scheme where you divide up your produce into a certain number of shares and people buy it. And a lot of the farmers began to compete with one another based on convenience. We'll deliver to your door. We'll wash the vegetables before we deliver them. Mm-hmm. And the more it became about convenience and less about a real partnership between the farmer and the consumer, the more thinned out it became. And then people would like, well, I can get a few more tomatoes from this farmer over here. And it, you know, this element of competition came into it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm, in fact, right now trying to help start a new kind of CSA in Wisconsin over near Milwaukee and East Troy, because I think some of the original spirit of the CSA movement has been lost. Well, there's no question about that. There's still great CSAs out there, mind you. I'm not trashing the CSA movement or any particular farmer, but it's not as vital. I mean, it grew fast, you know, like...
Well, so did co-ops, too, right?
Right.
You know, and where these food co-ops were... Convenience, there's a lot of money out there in the world, at, you know, maybe it's all piled up on top, but there's, you know, they're able to buy it right at our local food co-op, you know, and maybe they're not willing to go through the work. Because it used to be you also put in time on the farm where you had so many hours you had to put in or
that's
as a member.
Variable, right? You could do that, right? Yeah. You could.
You know, this is interesting, Paul. This actually gets into one of the insights that Rudolf Steiner had into social life, if I can.
Sure, go
if
on.
I can mention
we got to get back on the real
topic. No, it's good.
Let's
good.
Kind of talk but stop it's talking good. About potato heads and let's get good. Into it's real
good.
Life.
It's good to make it very concrete. So one of his insights was that social movements have a kind of lifespan and they need to be constantly rejuvenated. There is no way to create a kind of social program that's going to fix everything and last forever.
Hmm.
And this goes for things like the food co-op movement. I mean, look at co-ops now. Come on. I mean, can we just be serious for a moment?
Come on.
They're like businesses, basically. There's very little interaction between the consumer and that co-op. I mean, yes, you join a membership fee. But in the beginning, my God, they were vital centers of social renewal. I mean, we can still remember that, maybe.
We had the 1,000-foot one here.
The tiny one, yeah.
Right. Yeah. So, what this shows you is that any social movement has to constantly be rejuvenated and renewed from the source, from those idealistic roots, because life evolves, life changes. We can't ever just sit back and relax. Yeah, we figured it out.
Interesting. That's very real.
Yeah.
It's a very real... Yeah, nothing.
I mean, Whole Foods looks like a fancy Walmart, you're saying. Is that what you're saying?
Whole Foods has its place in the world.
Yeah,
You know, the ownership of Whole Foods is unfortunate, I would say. But anyway, yeah, we can get...
Yeah. We don't have to get into that because we've got other things to cover.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, that's...
But that's fun that you experience that process of the birth of healthy eating. We still have a long way to go on this earth because there's a lot more poisons on our shelves that are coming our way.
Exactly. And I had never heard of a CSA till we moved to Viroqua. I'm pretty sure of that.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, maybe, not that...
We lived in California before that.
Yeah, but in a big city where we weren't near a farm. And then...
Well, there's a huge one out there. That doesn't matter. We're doesn't off matter. The CSA thing.
Doesn't matter. I'm just saying.
We got more social things.
CSAs are great. It's super important.
Okay, so on to this idea of... So I heard of Threefold Social last year. You did a presentation.
Yeah.
You did a little intro in one of our Driftless United for Health Freedom evenings.
Yeah.
You did a small evening, and that was very inspiring. And we're like... That's interesting stuff. And so it kind of piqued my interest, and I didn't pursue it then. So I'm ready to hear that little review for me and everybody
okay.
listening.
Okay. Well, maybe I'll just start by saying you mentioned the Waldorf schools, and a lot of people don't know the backstory to the Waldorf schools, which is that Rudolf Steiner, in between the two wars, so... World War I ended, right? Central Europe is completely devastated. I mean, it's hard for us to imagine the level of devastation. And people came to Rudolf Steiner, who was already at that time a well-known spiritual teacher, thought leader, intellectual, and asked, you know, what caused this war? And is there anything we could do to prevent another war? And he began to give these talks and have these conversations about the threefold nature of social life, okay? And a whole movement grew up around that. I'll get into what that means in a moment, but just to say there was a lot of energy because at that time it was like we got to rebuild Europe from scratch in a way, right? The system's broken. If it, you know, if we succumb to that level of civil war, you could almost say, in Europe. It was like a civil war.
So close. I mean, be like our states
I
going
mean,
to war.
It was. Yeah. So anyway, that movement was active for a period of, I don't know, maybe 10 years. And they tried to get initially Germany to take a different approach, to adopt something like a threefold charter. And that failed ultimately. And... the way it failed had to do with the way the war ended, what's called the Treaty of Versailles, which put all the blame for World War I onto Germany, which all the historians now know that's not actually true. it was a much more complicated picture, but all this blame and all this debt and guilt was put onto Germany, and Steiner just saw it was not going to be possible. Like, people wouldn't think outside the box of, you know, democratic republicans, democratic socialism, communism, the idea of a whole new picture of social life, a threefold social life, people just couldn't wrap their minds around at that time. And so at one point, people said something to Dr. Steiner, like, what do we do? And he said, well, you know, we have to start with the children. The reason the adults can't think outside these usual boxes they're in is because of the form of education they've had. Huh. And this actually was a big part of what led to the founding of the first Waldorf school. And what's kind of strange now is that the Waldorf school and a lot of these other movements have grown up, and people have a little bit forgot about its origins in the movement for social threefolding. So that's a little historical background. What is social threefolding? So maybe the one doorway into that is to say that all of our social structures, whether they are the Constitution of the United States or the structure of our county government or our economic life, our cultural life, they are all ultimately based on a way of understanding the human being, right? So if we think the human being is just an animal in a fight with one another for survival, then we create an economic life, for example, where anything goes, right? It's survival of the fittest. It's dog eat dog. These are real ideas that have informed our current social structure, ideas about who we are. So social threefolding is based ultimately on the idea that we are beings of body, soul, and spirit. We are not simply highly evolved animals. We are spiritual beings who've come into earthly life with a purpose, with goals and intentions. And the question then, you know, becomes, what is a healthy social order that allows threefold human beings to realize their inherent potential? And Rudolf Steiner began to talk about how we could create a threefold social organism, is what he actually called it, that reflected and that nurtured, you could say, the wholeness of the human being, the fullness of ourselves as a being of body, soul, and spirit. And put very simply, at the level of our body, in a certain way, we're connected to economic life. We all have physical needs. We need homes, and we need clothes, and we need food. And there's a certain part of our society that has to do with meeting one another's needs and how we do that. And it's important at this time in history to rethink a bit, how do we go about meeting one another's needs? As I said, social life has to be constantly rejuvenated. So threefolding is a way to bring new ideas in. So at the level of the body, we have an economic life. At the level of the soul, we can get into what we mean by that in social threefolding, but that's the level of agreements that we make with one another that ultimately has to do with laws, has to do with the realm of rights. And at the level of spirit is where we are each seeking our own individual and utterly unique self-expression through ideas, through beliefs, through the doctors we choose, through the schools we choose. It's about our self-development. And what Steiner pointed out is that these three aspects of life, of society, are very distinct, and they have their own unique laws. They can't be blended up together. The economic life, he said, wants to unfold on the basis of fraternity, of mutuality, of cooperation. It's not primarily about competition. If you look at any given product on the marketplace, huge networks of cooperation were needed to get that product to market. Mm-hmm. Yes, there's a little bit of competition at the level of the shelf, but the economic life is primarily about competition. The rights life is primarily about the principle of equality. We're all equal before the law. We all should have an equal say in laws and agreements that will affect all of us. And the spiritual life, or what Rudolf Steiner called the spiritual cultural life, is ultimately should be based on the principle of freedom, that we each need to have a great deal of freedom to explore who we are, what we believe, what our talents are, what schools we want to go to, what doctors or healing we want to pursue. So this is the basic overview, mm-hmm. Okay?
That is a great overview.
Speaking of freedom, which is the spiritual aspect, WDRT, the freedom to speak, the freedom to share songs, ideas,
yes,
possibilities. It's wide open. Thank you, WDRT, for with having such an open heart and mind.
Yes.
Yeah, and just
our body in there too.
And if you're just joining us, which I sure hope you're not, because that was an amazing first 20 minutes. Our guest today is Robert Kabelnikoff. He's a social activist inspired by Rudolf Steiner's vision of a threefold social organism. If you did miss that intro, you better look him up at www.robertkarp.net if you're being intrigued. Let's go on.
So with the Waldorf world, they talk about the head, heart, and hands. Does that fit in there? The body's the head?
Totally.
The spirit's the heart, and the hands are the... the laws, or is the hands the body, probably? Actually,
no, the hands are the economic life, the body.
Okay.
The heart.
The doing.
The heart is more connected to our community agreements, our rights life.
The feeling?
The feeling, and the head has a certain relationship to the spiritual cultural life because it begins with our freedom of thought, our ability to think as we wish to think.
The choice to believe.
Choice to believe, the choice to not believe.
The choice to pray or not to pray, whatever the case may be.
And just to give you a concrete example, right? So the government can create the freedom for something like WDRT to exist, right? The government can establish that anybody can start a radio company, whatever it's called, a radio program. But imagine if the government says, well, since we've created this right, now we need to actually be the ones to start these radio stations. Stations, that's the word I was looking for. Yeah, so the government's now going to start radio stations. Now, what's going to happen to the principle of freedom if the government's running all the radio stations, right? And then we're going to wind up in a big political battle about what content gets to go on there, right? Instead of creative people running that radio station, designing it around their own interests, their own beliefs, just let them have at it. We've got a school board, which is what we have in public education. We have school boards in which the democratic principle is trying to be applied to something that belongs in the free spiritual cultural life. We don't need democratic structures to dictate to cultural structures what to do.
Wow, that's where we get in trouble.
That is where we get in trouble, on the one hand.
If the radio stations are being supported by the gov, they got to follow the gov, right? And if the public education then gets handed down, what type of medicines do my kids have to have before they can come here? What type of clothes do they wear? What type of, all those things. What type of... that it's supposed to not be together, state and religion, state and belief, state and freedom of health choice, state, all those things. You're like, it's a mix, but we need help. And that's as, I didn't say this earlier, but the Waldorf school world comes to head, heart, and hands, is now supported somewhat by the state, which changes some of the things they can do. That we're not going to go there, but that's...
An interesting question. We could get into the question of choice programs and how they work and whether this is a healthy model, because the state does have some responsibility, I would say, to ensure that any parent can send their child to any school regardless of their economic conditions. Mm-hmm. Right? So the government does have a right in establishing a role in establishing a right to education. It just shouldn't try to fulfill that right. Mm-hmm. Now, whether and how it could play a role in addressing the economic differences in society that would allow a parent to send their child to any school, that would be an interesting discussion.
Yeah.
We could have.
I'm not saying either, I don't want to get into politics. So I want to get into possibilities of a social, but that's where it gets all muddy, right? That's where things get, it's yes. Great ideas get really muddy and they start regulation of food. Can I just go buy a beef from my Amish friend, organic? Oh boy, next thing you know, they're almost in jail not too long back because they were selling meat off the farm. And I mean, this and raw milk. Oh, raw milk's bad for you. Who said that? Wow, what government agency's saying that? Oh, who are they getting paid by? It's like, that's where things get muddy. And it's like, oh, do we have peer freedom? Well, that doesn't always work so well either. So it's a tough road to hoe, but we're in the crux of it right now in the world and trying to find those fine lines and seeing if we can work it out. But let's keep going. Let's dig into this possibility, but a lot of people haven't seen threefold. So did we get lost, or do you know where we're at?
You got lost.
I got lost. I got triggered.
No, I will say, Paul, I think you're right. I mean, the U.S. Constitution did separate church and state, but there's a lot of other aspects now that also need to be clearly separated, clearly differentiated, like you just said, like government and education, government and food, government and medicine, right? These are all things that if our Constitution was going to evolve, it would need to encompass. And part of the idea in threefolding is simply that human beings have continued to evolve. We're different beings than we were 200 years ago. Mm-hmm. And we're capable of taking full responsibility for our spiritual, cultural lives now. And the government had a more paternalistic role in the past, right? It guided people. This is what you should eat. There was a time where it was appropriate to have public education. The point is not that, again, you can't create a social structure that's good for all time. There was a time when it was appropriate, but guess what? It's no longer appropriate. And so many of the culture wars would just dissolve if we could make some of these changes and just allow people. Like, I don't want to impose Waldorf education on the world. Like, imagine if, like, we had a huge majority of Waldorf people. We're going to take over the government, and we're going to make y'all go to Waldorf schools. No, that's not the point. Let's let anybody start a school that they think is a good idea. And if they can get parents to send their children, and if it works out well, cool.
Why not?
Like, we want freedom in the spiritual, cultural life.
We do.
Yeah. And the Amish have their own schools at the moment, right? I mean, there is.
And they had to fight for that. I mean, they had to. Yeah.
Yeah. Isn't there some states that you can't homeschool? That's a good question.
It's a good question.
Yeah. And there is due to poverty, there is a necessity to have some sort of options for people that can't afford to go do their own education, right? I mean, there is a place for public education, and I'm not saying I love it in a lot of ways. I do.
Well, just to say, from the perspective of social threefolding, what we're calling the duality between a public and a private school is kind of transcended, because what we're saying is that parents need to be able to send their children to any school. Okay, and there's financial support for that. It's just that anyone should be able to start a school. So if you can imagine anybody being able to start a school, but anybody being able to send their child to any of those schools, we're talking about a system that somewhat transcends the public-private school thing.
Well, that would be choice schools then, right? Or do you have to, I guess I don't know all the rules for that. That would be the...
How this is done financially is a bigger topic, and yeah. we could get into it, because the choice model, I would say, is very helpful, but it has some problems.
Yeah.
But this, you know, to me, there is no need to say maintain a public school and then give a certain amount of freedom over here. But we could just say all schools are now free, and we're going to put in place these structures to ensure that all parents can send their children to the schools of their choice.
Yeah, that would make...
And that would be what part of the threefold? That's the spirit, the freedom of education. That's the spirit when we're talking about...
Yeah, what we're working out right now in this conversation, you could say, is the relationship of the rights life to the spiritual cultural life. Where is the right role for the rights life with education? The right role for it is simply to ensure equal access, that all parents have equal access to any school of their choice. Their role should have nothing to do with curriculum. Of course, if a particular school starts breaking the law, starts stockpiling weapons, starts fomenting revolution, now they're breaking the law, and now the rights life has an appropriate role to step in and mm-hmm. say, sorry, your freedom in the cultural life, you have not used it right. You've broken laws, and so we're closing down your school. Thank you. You're not allowed to stockpile weapons. Okay, so finding the right relation between the rights life and the cultural life is a very key aspect within threefolding within society at this moment.
Yeah, it's a you know, you were saying then the 1900s, early 1900s, the people were having a hard time grasping this threefold social order.
Yeah.
It is definitely a topic that you, every time I like learn about another aspect of it, I was like, oh, wow. And you have to sit with it and you kind of come back and your brain has to kind of go, wow. Because the other day we were talking a lot about the economy.
Yeah. Right.
Realm, right? And that's the other... one of the other threes of the folds, right? And we talked about that, how that can play out.
Yeah, and the economy is something totally different again. So Rudolf Steiner once used a formula I'll mention. You know, he said what's trying to emerge in the cultural life, what we're just talking about now, is a kind of what we would call libertarianism, right? Yeah. Libertarianism has its right place in the cultural life. Democracy, the ideas of democracy, have their right place in the rights life. And then he actually said socialism, a kind of socialism, not state socialism, but a kind of voluntary socialism, has its right place in the economic life.
Right place.
So.
And the first one, libertarian, was the right place in the
cultural life.
In the cultural life.
Right. We need a kind of radical libertarianism in our cultural life. But in the economic life, we need something quite different. We need this kind of... Well, we see it emerging. We see it in the food movement. We see it in all kinds of people starting mission-driven businesses, right? Mm. Businesses, it's like our first goal as a business is to do good for the community, is to pay our employees a good wage, is to create products that are sustainable, that treat the earth well. That's the healthy impulse of a new economic life.
To give some of the profits away to charity.
Absolutely. This is all what's trying to emerge in the economic life is real sisterhood, brotherhood, mutuality.
Mission-driven. Yeah, because most companies hear that. What is your mission statement now, right? What is really at the root of what we're trying to do here?
Yeah.
Of course, we might make a profit, but our mission is to... reach the most people with healthy food we can, or...
Right, so you have something out there called B corporations or public benefit corporations. There's a lot of new models, people creating new kinds of ownership structures that, for example, there's something called trustee ownership or steward ownership, whereby companies at a certain point in their development place a big part of the intellectual property and the value of the company into a nonprofit trust so that it can't just be bought by the wealthiest owner and exploited to make a few people really wealthy. So this is the thing, like when we talk about cultural life, I'm gonna sound like a radical libertarian, But when we talk about the economic life, I'm going to sound a little bit more like a, I don't know, progressive-minded socialist or something. Like, mm-hmm. in economic life, that's where we really, our actions really affect everybody in a way that we need really thoughtful stewardship, not necessarily by the government, but by altruistic-minded individuals and groups. Hmm. So,
example?
An example of
that happening in the world where in the economic world, it's not controlled by the government, but people are somehow their social or their economic practices are practicing principles that help the community.
Yeah. Well, I'll give you an example. There's another organization. I mean, a lot of the ethical banks, the ethical banking movement began with actually Rudolf Steiner's ideas in Europe, the first ethical bank. And in this country, there's something called RSF Social Finance, which is a kind of a bank. People from all over the country put their money in it, and then they lend the money at very fair interest rates to people who want to do good work in the community. And they actually, to set the rates of like, okay, so it's not all gifted money, right? They loan the money. They bring the investors together with the people getting the money, and they have a conversation to set the interest rates.
Actually, our co-op was doing that, right? We had a, what was the lending amount where they had a certain amount of their money they were lending out?
Those microloans?
Yeah.
Microloans, yeah. I don't know how that turned out.
That people could apply for a microloan instead of a business to help.
There's a lot of like microlending institutions all over the world now, actually. And this is a wonderful thing. It's mission-driven investing, mission-driven lending. It's not lending and investing so that I can sit back and do nothing and make as much passive income as possible. It's investing to do the greatest possible good because capital has a mission in the world. Its mission is to help stimulate human creativity, right? So we need capital to be widely available to people.
What did you say? Help stimulate human creativity?
Yes.
So capital.
Yes.
What'd you say? Capital has a
mission.
capital itself has
capital
a mission.
Capital is, yeah. People need capital to realize their ideas, their initiatives, to go to school, to start a business. And so we have a need in society to have affordable capital widely available, either in the form of gifts or in the form of loans. And so this is a big part.
You say
of,
we have that, meaning our society has that?
Yeah, as a society, we need, I mean, it's just like parents capitalize their children, right? We mm-hmm, mm-hmm. take care of them so mm-hmm. that they can realize their creative abilities. And, you know, so I'm just saying this is another realm of society where we can make the economic life a lot more humane. Mm-hmm. is by taking capital out of the hands of just profit-making companies. For example, a very simple thing the state could do is to say that if you want to be a bank or you want to be an investment company, you can only do that through certain legal structures that are like nonprofit organizations. Like there's a limit to how much profit you can make on that. This is mm-hmm. a service. Like why should for-profit companies start schools? Why should for-profit companies run banks? You see, this is where I start to sound like a socialist. I'm not talking about taking away the free initiative, but the degree of profits that we allow people to make off of money. I mean, it's scandalous, and it's degrades, I would say, the moral character of our society to just have such immense sums of wealth floating out there in the hands of so few people. But it's not like the government has to solve this problem in a very elegant way. Not we're going to take over the owns of the means of production. We're going to set limits on how much money you can make. It doesn't have to be so complicated. The government could just do a couple of things that would begin to ease up these kinds of issues.
Is that called taxes?
This tax and redistribute model has been there a long time, and it really doesn't work. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In a way, it's saying to companies, yes, go ahead and exploit all you want. We don't care if you exploit the earth, but now we're going to tax you and redistribute that money. I mean, what have you really accomplished? The company can still go and exploit, and now you tax and redistribute. I mean, to me, I'm more of the belief that companies should get a charter, right? This is the old-fashioned corporate charter, and there should be very clear, defined responsibilities of anyone who has a corporate charter. Environmental responsibilities, what you can and can't do with the earth, how you treat your employees. And you should be able to pull corporate charters very readily. But if they're doing good, you just leave them alone and let them do good.
Who should be able to pull the corporate charter?
The rights life.
The rights part of the
I think so. I mean, I'm still working out in my mind how I think this would work best.
Right.
But that's one model. Mm-hmm. The problem is, to me, it isn't a problem that we treat corporations as individuals. The problem is we don't have clear rights and responsibilities for those corporate individuals. We give them way too much freedom. Mm. It's just sort of like, oh, yeah, go do whatever you want.
It's like, oh, you can corporate, and now you can just run wild.
You got a corporation. I mean, those corporate charters should be to carry out specific things in specific places. And if it's going to involve land and natural resources, then, yeah, there has to be some discussion about that, because that's a legacy that belongs to all of us.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. The legacy of WDRT is the spirit of the heart and the spirit of freedom, freedom to speak, freedom to share. And thank you for tuning in to WDRT 91.9, Heart of Wellness.
Yes, we are deep. Now we're going deep into this discussion with Robert Kobelnikoff.
I don't know if this is where you guys wanted to go. But.
This is the beauty of WDRT and the Heart of Wellness. We can go wherever we want.
Yeah.
But we're really chewing in on this threefold social idea. Again, if you're coming in midstream, or even if you have with us since the beginning of this hour, you can reach Robert at www.robertkarp.net to look him up with any further questions. This might be a good time to say, Robert, I know sometimes in this community, if people do live locally, that you give workshops on occasion,
yes.
Which can really be helpful for people like me to get its sound bites of information and chew on it a little more to the next moment in time.
Yes.
Do you have any coming up?
Yeah, actually, my colleague, Seth Jordan, is coming back into town in February. He and I do a lot of threefolding workshops.
Okay.
And we're doing a workshop, I think it's February 20th to the 23rd, and it's called E Pluribus Unum.
E Pluribus Unum.
Yeah.
Latin thrown at us.
Latin, which is means something like, you know, though many, we are one.
Though many, we are one.
Yeah. And we're really going to be working with, yeah, I think our subtitle is something like finding a pathway from difference to social cohesion. So how do we move beyond just all the differences? Political differences, social differences, racial differences. We are bound to have more and more differences in society because people are becoming more and more individual, different belief systems, different ideas. But how do we find unity? How do we actually depolarize our political life? How do we learn as groups to both honor these differences but to find unity through them, right? This is, you know, I've been somewhat of a critic of the social justice movement because they focus so much on the differences and not on what we have in common as human beings. Because it's only through what we have in common that we can ultimately then work together. Right? It's not about who do we need to blame. It's about how do we right now get to work together. So anyway, Seth and I are going to be taking up this theme. Very concretely, we'll do a lot of exercises and work together how we learn to become, you know, effective, holistic social activists in our own lives and in our communities, and start to bridge the incredible divides that we have.
That's nice.
So here's a question from a threefold view. Are we moving in the right direction going back 1,000 years, you know, going back 2,000 years, 1,500? Like, are you know,
are we as a
society, you know, people think, oh my God, this is the end of the world. We're, you know, we're at the pit of the pit.
Yeah.
I mean, we, you know, Vietnam being, you know, at least in America, we haven't seen as much damage, but World War One, World Two were obviously pretty intense worldwide. We've had the opportunity to blow ourselves up for how many years now?
40? With the atomic bomb?
Yeah. And we haven't. You know, so except for the ones that were dropped,
right,
you know, and so have we improved in the form of, are we actually becoming less violent and more cohesive, even though it appears that, oh my God, if you watch media or social media, it's the end of the world. You know, that's like, are we moving towards a society that we actually all have a chance.
You should have attended the Anthroposophical Festival, Paul.
I heard a lot from you.
Well, I think, I mean, I do think that Rudolf Steiner had a helpful insight regarding that question, Paul, because he talked about something called the evolution of consciousness, and that humanity is involved in an evolution of consciousness. And it's not just an evolution that's like straight directional up, right? It's so, for example, the further back in history we go, generally speaking, we find more cohesive societies, but they were more ethnically based, right? So we find cultures that created their own social structures. And people had a very strong group consciousness, right? A very strong
tribal
consciousness. And over time, these tribal ties, these kind of instinctive ways of forming social orders, have fallen away because it's part of human evolution that the individual had to emerge. This is sort of like what happens in human development, right? Like, we're born little children, we're nested in the family, everything's copacetic, and suddenly 12, 13, 14, whoa, we emerge as individuals, and we're not, you know, we push against those instinctive familial ties. Mm-hmm. And this is something the whole human race is going through. We're going through a cultural adolescence right now. And we have, in many parts of the world, rejected the old ways of being, you know.
That's a great way to look at it.
That's really beautiful.
And the question is, you know, an adolescent can either stay in rebellion mode, just stay in rejection mode, just ultimately wind up kind of as a kind of nihilist or an addict, or like just have no future, or they find within themselves their own adult, their inner mature self that wants to take responsibility. And this is, you know, are there enough human beings on the planet now as beings of body, soul, and spirit that can rise up and begin to shape social life, not out of an old ethnic, racial, you know, social instinct of some kind, but out of a conscious knowledge, conscious love for one another as human beings, right? It all now has to come from the individual. There is no like big authority, you know, the idea that big government is gonna save us, right?
Yeah, right.
You know, or big corporations for that matter, mm-hmm. you know, or it's just not gonna happen. It's gonna mm-hmm. come through really creative, spiritually awake individuals.
Mm-hmm. Which is a beautiful moment in history or whatever in our consciousness of evolution, like here we go. You know, we're all in this together. I mean, this is really true. We're really all in this together, and can we rise up individually to find this way, this cohesive way to be together?
It wasn't that long ago there was less than 1 billion people on the planet.
What does that mean? I mean, what?
I mean, why is there 1 billion people on the planet? Or, I mean, 8 billion plus. You know, like, is there a spiritual reason for that? You know, that's what I would ask, like, the question, like, actually, for 8 billion people on the planet, we're doing pretty good. You know, it's, if you throw a few cows out in the pasture, they usually don't, you know, especially some bulls out there. You know,
there's always Robert, this is your Paul's farm analogies. Yeah, 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 wait, yeah, no, yeah, what are we saying?
They're fine. They're fine. Yeah. But you throw them in a pen, whoa. You know, they start some pretty big battles, you know, that you yes. just, but if they're out of pasture, they're, you know, they're spread out and they're doing their thing.
So are you referencing that we have a lot of people on the planet and we're pretty packed.
I'm not saying we, but we can get a little irritated, you know, with the space. Mm-hmm. And we're doing pretty darn good for that. You know, it's for having that many people on the planet. It was 1940? Was the last time, the first time we had a billion? Like we hit a billion?
Usually Dan will come up with that.
Yeah, Dan will come up with that. but like, it's like we can pat ourselves on the back that actually we're getting along pretty darn good for this big of a crowd, you know, for this big of a crowd on the planet and the different views we have.
You might think it's pretty good, but someone else might not think it's pretty good.
What was it? 1804. So that's...
We had a billion people in 1804.
Yeah.
And now we have 7.
So that's like 200, 300 years. That's like a snap of the finger.
What is your point?
1927 is the 2 billion.
I mean, I think, first of all, there is a reason spiritually why there's so many people on the planet.
I agree.
And I think that's because this is the place to be if you're a human being right now. I mean, yes, it's an incredible risk, right? It's incredible ways that we could throw our lives away or throw our civilization away, but it's also the most incredible opportunity to awaken right now. Hmm. And there's like a developmental leap happening in human civilization. And people want to be here. People want to be incarnate for that.
Yes, we spirits do.
And some don't, right? Some people are jumping out. Some people are like, I'm out of here.
A lot of people are checking out because it's also, again, from an anthroposophical point of view, the powers of evil, the powers that don't want human beings to make this developmental leap, have become stronger than ever. Like we have to really push against resistance to get there.
I always... Just always, you know, he does farm analogies. I do like Disney flick analogies, right? So I feel like we're at this moment where Jafar, if you've ever watched Aladdin, has gained some power. And he's, you know, in that scene where he's like spinning around, his eyes are getting all crazy. And, you know, a little Aladdin is stuck in the cave with the magic carpet trying to break free to right the ship here, bring balance back. So there are... feels like forces. We could go all in. It's a whole nother should we go into the deep state or call whatever you want out there. But there seems to be forces that want to be in control and power and greed. And then there's the individuals, a lot of us going, how can we live together peacefully? Can we make this work?
Exactly. And this is where, I mean, I think we need good ideas right now. So there is a kind of battle of ideas happening too. Like what are the ideas that can free us and take us further? And this is, you know, I just think threefolding has a lot to offer this question of like, how do we begin to create a humane society in which people feel their dignity is actually respected,
right.
met?
Do you know her, the woman Brené Brown?
Yeah.
She's out there. So she wrote a book called Braving the Wilderness back in 2016. Right after that election, she looked at how society was so...
Polarized,
crazy after that election. Well, I picked up that book in 2020. I'm thinking, you thought 2016 was wild. I'm thinking we need these ideas now. And she had kind of a little formula, like, how can we work together and see each other and, you know, find each other's differences and all that really good stuff. She had a little formula, and we had a little book club about it. Well, now 4 years later, now here we are again. People are mad crazy out there in polarity. So it's like, wow, how can social threefolding bring us to a place of
how many minutes we got left?
Or something? What do we got, Dan? Well, five minutes.
So to continue. No. How could that is a good question. Like, how can this threefold? Like, where do you see like the summary of where those ideas and ideal work in society, and where could we fit them in? Like, just kind of a little summary of that.
Well, we could, you know, I could say a little bit more about depolarization just in the sense of when we look at society through this threefold lens, we see that the political left and the political right both have a contribution toward a healthy threefold society, and both of them have a big blind spot, mm-hmm. right? And so this is where I think a threefold movement needs to build on the best of our progressive and conservative social movements, right? Because we just have to come to realize that we have progressives and we have conservatives for a reason, for a good reason. They both represent and are sensitive to certain things in society that are important. Mm-hmm. We need a vision, however, of the whole that can encompass both of them and can help us deal with the big blind spots that both of these sides tend to have, because they do. Mm-hmm. So I'm really interested in depolarization work, bringing liberals and conservatives together to try to find, you know, common ground and common mm-hmm. perspectives. And I would say at this moment, this is a little bit of a superficial analysis, but I think it's true, is that if you look at a lot of the most creative things happening in the economic life, things like I spoke of before, like trustee ownership or new kinds of cooperatives and cooperations and B corporations, a lot of that is coming from social progressives. They have a real gift with rethinking economic practices to make them more humane, right? Or microfinance. A lot of this has come from progressives. On the other hand, if we look for where are the voices emerging around issues of health freedom, educational freedom, freedom of speech, these are coming from often from the conservative side. They have a real sensitivity to the need for the cultural life to be based on freedom. Mm-hmm. And so if we want to work toward a whole society, we have to honor that these two different social movements are sensitive to some really important aspect of social life. But the tragedy now is they're both fighting to control the rights life, to control the government. And you can see the government's like the heart. It's like the heart. Everybody wants to control the heart. We want the heart to be driven by our value systems, and we're going to impose our value systems through the Supreme Court, through Congress, you know, on the rest of the population. So that's not a healthy picture. We really need to rethink our electoral processes, right? We got to get money completely out of politics. Mm-hmm. And that means not only corporate money, it means the political parties themselves, okay? So from a threefold perspective, the political parties are like cultural groups manipulating the electoral process.
So no party system would be a...
Absolutely. You should be allowed to have a left. You can have a progressive social movement. You can have a conservative social movement. You just can't use that movement to fund political campaigns, to fund political candidates. You can endorse candidates, but sorry, people can't identify with your party. No, that's of the past. A lot of the illness in our social life is we carry these things from the past that at one time were useful, at one time they made sense. They don't make sense anymore. We have to reform our whole electoral process.
The waste of energy and money in the fight.
Think about it.
Every
the amount of money
2 years, every 4 years,
is obscene.
Yes,
it's tragic when we think about the social problems in our midst. Yeah. It's
millions and millions and millions. I mean, the only thing worse would be maybe the military the budget. You know, that's every second. How many?
Yeah, that's a whole nother hour. Okay.
Dan has that locked in.
Well, guess what? We're at the end of this hour, Robert.
Wow.
How did that happen?
How did that happen?
I just want to remind our listeners that, you know, if you have questions hanging there, www.robertkarp.net, K-A-R-P, to find Robert Kabelnikov. If you have questions for him, that's a place you can find him.
And,
right?
And what book would they go to if they wanted threefold? Like, is there?
That's a complicated question, Paul. I'm going to direct them, actually, if they want to read some great articles about threefolding related to contemporary social issues, they should go to the Substack account of my friend Seth Jordan, which is called The Whole Social.
Okay.
And Seth has, first of all, a great resources page where you can find all the kind of books and pamphlets. And then Seth writes about all kinds of contemporary social issues through a threefold lens. He and I don't agree on everything, but I think it's the best resource out there right now. It's called The Whole Social.
Whole Social. Excellent. Beautiful. We're going to end on that. Thank you so much, Robert, for joining us. It was a fascinating hour. Everyone have a great day.
Thanks to both of you for having me. This was really fun.
Super fun.
Conversations we must have.
Yes.